Coming up on Tech News Weekly, it's me, Jason Howell. Micah and Ant are out, so you've got me for the full hour. We've got some great interviews and a story of the week. Interviews starting with the new Apple iPad hardware, you may have heard. We got some new hardware earlier this week, and Zach Hall from 9 to 5 Mac has the details on that. Samantha Goldhart from iFixit actually tore down this, the Pixel Watch, the Google Pixel Watch, tore it down, has some really interesting insights into Google's first-gen wearable hardware there. Netflix is reinventing itself. Yonka Rutgers from Protocol has all the details, the many different facets, the many different ways that Netflix is looking at its business and changing things around a little bit. And then I talk all about how we retain, how we organize digital media, and the challenges that creates year after year. We want to keep it all coordinated and keep it close to our hearts. And all that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly episode 257, recorded Thursday, October 20th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Podium. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/twit. And by SecureWorks. Are you ready for inevitable cyber threats? SecureWorks detects evolving adversaries and defends against them with a combination of security analytics and threat intelligence directly from their own counter-threat unit. Visit secureworks.com/twit to get a free trial of Taegis Extended Detection and Response, also referenced as XDR. And by Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat devoted to simplifying tech topics and providing insight for a new generation of IT professionals. Listen to Compiler in your favorite podcast player. Hello, welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where every week we talk to people who are making and breaking the tech news. I'm Jason Howell. I'm here solo today. Micah is out getting some much needed time off still, thankfully. Good for him. I know it's hard for him to take that time off, so I'm applauding him for doing so. Ant could not make it today as well. So it's me. We are loaded with the guests, with interviews. And why don't we just get right to it? Because we got a lot of really interesting stuff to talk about today. So first things first, you may have noticed earlier this week, Apple announced new iPad hardware. Some of the announcements seemed to leave people a little surprised, maybe a little confused. It didn't really get an event. There's just some things going on here. So joining me to talk through the new devices and everything behind it is Zach Hall from 9 to 5 Mac. Welcome back, Zach.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
You bet. It's great to get you on. Thanks for coming on to talk about this new hardware, because anytime there's like an Apple announcement of new hardware, especially with a lineup as successful as the iPad, we got to dive into it. And this time around, there's definitely some story to create. So let's start with the base model iPad. That saw a pretty substantial upgrade, I would say, compared to what we're going to talk about a little bit later. I think I saw a lot of people saying, this is actually the more exciting news. So talk a little bit about what it offers. Why are people so excited about the base model upgrades?
Sure. So now the base model iPad has an all-screen design like the iPad Pro, Air, and Mini from the last several years. So it's the first iPad standalone name to not have the big bezels on the top and bottom and the home button for Touch ID. Now that's a side button with Touch ID like the other iPads, Mini and Air. The screen size goes up from 10.2 inches to 10.9 inches, which is like 1.2 inches larger than 9.7 where they were just a few years ago. And processor-wise, it has the A14 chip like the iPhone 12 does from just a couple of years ago. So still pretty new. And it's the first iPad, no name after that, to go from Lightning to USB-C. So once the iPad 9 goes away, still for sale now, then all iPads will use USB-C. And then lastly, I think one of the more exciting things about it is, it comes in color. So you get silver, blue, yellow, pink. But the real big thing is that it has a landscape camera. So when you hold the iPad, like wide view, the camera is in the center where you expect it and not under your left hand. So that's great.
I mean, people seem to freak out about that a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about why this and why they weren't freaking out about the Pro here in a second. But why are people so excited about the landscape camera placement? I mean, I see, on the some of the promotional images, you've got a little attachment for a keyboard case and everything like that. So is that why? Because when it's in that landscape view, you get the camera where you expect it. And before, was it so distracting that it was on the side that it was turning people off?
I think it was like a Steve Jobs thing where the iPad 1 and 2 had the camera in the center because he, you know, the way he viewed it is like you're browsing the web and like portrait mode orientation at least and like reading a book that way and everything. And like lately, iPads have really been alternatives to PCs and even Macs. So we look at it as like a tablet that can become a computer basically, or like a laptop basically. And so we're using them in like widescreen video calls, and we do that everywhere on PC and Mac. On iPhone, you know, it's portrait, but that's because you're on your phone, not because your screen is, you know, it's the size and everything. For the landscape camera here, it's nice because, like you mentioned, Apple does sell keyboard cases that they really promote with their iPads. And if you use it that way, which is a fantastic way to use it with a mouse and keyboard, a trackpad and keyboard, then the camera would be on the left center. So like imagine if you had a MacBook or a PC notebook and like your webcam wasn't in the top center or even like bottom center, it was like on the left center, that'd be very weird. And
very
made,
weird, yeah.
Yeah, it made your video calls, you know, like the side of your face was in focus instead of the center. You're looking on the wrong area. And then, so that's the big thing. And then I think for the Pro, which we'll talk about more in a moment, it's very important because you have Face ID. And if you hold it in landscape orientation, your left hand often covers the Face ID sensor, which unlocks your iPad for you. So in that case, it's like people would love for that to go in the middle of the landscape orientation way.
That makes a lot more sense. And I appreciate what you mentioned as far as like the Steve Jobs era kind of iPad, paradigm, let's say, and kind of where we're at now, because you're right. When the tablets came out, they were really intended or really marketed as being, it's like your phone, but bigger. And so, you know, we hold our phone, portrait. It would be really weird if the way we operated our phone was in landscape. So of course the camera up top makes sense. But when you get into these larger screen sizes, at least to my mind, maybe I'm old school, but that landscape view really does make more sense in a lot of ways. The media that we're watching, the calls that we're connecting to, and everything. So that makes a lot more sense. It's just interesting to see the demarcation between the Jobs era approach to this stuff and how we've really moved beyond that into kind of the next evolution of what these things can be. So that's cool. So it's kind of along those lines, you know, Apple also unveiled kind of new iPad Pro lineup, assumed by, I think, the name itself to be the everything model. Yet people seem very confused, very in some ways disappointed about what Apple showed off. So talk a little bit about what the Pro, the everything model, doesn't have.
So if the iPad Pro, the new model, existed on its own, it'd be perfectly normal as a spec bump.
Right.
But because the cheaper iPad got that landscape camera and the iPad Pro is updated on the same exact day and comes out the same exact day on next Friday, people really wonder, why didn't it get the landscape camera? Because, you know, you pay the most for an iPad between $800 and like $2,400 when you get a Pro. You expect it to have the best of everything. And frankly, it doesn't have the landscape camera. So that's kind of weird. And then also the iPad 10, the cheaper one, got an accessory called the Magic Keyboard Folio, which is the trackpad plus keyboard. And it has a full function row of keys, including the escape key, a Siri key, an emoji key. Like it's everything you'd want from an iPad keyboard. And it's two separate pieces. It's got like a very adjustable kickstand sort of back to it. And the iPad Pro version that's been around for a couple of years now, it does not have function keys, no escape key, very limited viewing angles. And again, like that's the Pro version. The thing that you'd want the most is like, you know, media controls and all those keys that you'd use as a professional user. And right now, I'd say like for the next 18 months, we're not going to have that. It's only on the cheaper model that it doesn't have, you know, all the hardware and everything that the Pro has, but it does have those two things that make it kind of better.
Yeah. And I mean, Apple, you know, totally does this in my view. And I think you would agree, you know, it's kind of like, here's a new feature. It can only come to one of these devices. Guaranteed it's going to come down the line to these things. It's almost like every year you have another year to look forward to for some reason, whether you like it or not. It's like, you're going to have to wait for that. But next year it'll come probably. And when it does, you'll probably be more likely to upgrade to it. Now, this iPad Pro has the M2 chip, of course. That's, you know, that upgrade isn't nothing. That's a nice upgrade to have. The question that I have about the M2 is the pencil compatibility here. Is that this has a new hovering feature. I've seen this and actually use this in use on like Samsung Note devices, where you hover over the top and it kind of opens up some new functionality. That can be pretty cool. But in this case, it's Apple says that it's tied to the M2, which to my mind, I'm kind of like, is it really? I don't know. It sounds a little odd to me. What's your take on that?
Well, firstly, I would describe what you're talking about with like, there's always 1 year that you've got to wait for the next feature to come to the iPad as like interstate construction. Like, it's never done.
Yeah.
It's always something.
Right.
totally. And in this case, the M2 upgrade, it has some things like speed improvements and faster video rendering. And then you can take ProRes video with the iPad now, like you could on the phone for a couple of years. But the verdict is really still out there for whether or not the hover feature is hardware or software. The Apple Pencil 2 can do a version of it on iPad OS 16 in general on any iPad that works with the Pencil 2. It's for an accessibility feature called hover that you use to aim the pencil over text and it will read that text for you. And that uses hover, like you're millimeters away from the screen and it uses that. But it could be that this implementation on the new iPad with M2 is just much more functional because it does things like preview what your paintbrush will look like or expands the drawing area that you're going to have or like mix colors on the palette. So it does do more, but I think it's like 90% software limitation and not hardware.
Yeah, that's kind of my impression too. But, you know, again, maybe that ends up being something that's like, you know what? You loved it so much, we decided to bring it to all iPads. Yeah, I can totally see that happening. Now, speaking of the pencil, there's a little bit of a change because you talked a little bit a few minutes ago about the change in ports on some of these devices, and it seems to impact the pencil in some way. I don't necessarily feel like having a cord that, you know, that goes in between is the end of the world, because I feel like, you know, having a pencil sticking out the side of your tablet might not be the most ideal situation either. But talk a little bit about how this has changed and how it interferes with what we were talking about earlier, that camera placement.
Sure. So the Apple Pencil 2, it pairs and charges magnetically on the right or top side of the iPad Pro, Air, and Mini. The iPad 10 moved the camera to where the charger sensor is. So that might be why the camera didn't move on the Pro this year. They just didn't want to change too much inside about it. I think it's very possible, though, that they could move the charger to the edge where the camera was, and that would work on everything maybe but the iPad Mini. And then in terms of the way that the iPad 10 works, it's the 2015 Apple Pencil that has USB-C and a cap that you can lose, doesn't have as many features. It's, you know, charging via a magnetic connection on the iPad is supernatural. Charging with the iPad 10 with like a cable or plugging it into the iPad, kind of awkward. But in this case, you know, it's lightning on the Apple Pencil, the same like the iPhone charger is, and then it doesn't plug in without an adapter and cable to the iPad 10. I think in that case, probably like, maybe just don't buy the iPad 10 for pencil use and just buy it as an iPad.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And that's probably what they're thinking as well.
Probably so. Okay. So and this leads really perfectly into my next question, my next thing that I was thinking about here, which is that there are now 5 separate iPad models. You go to Apple's site and I mean, it's a cornucopia of a gallery view of different iPad models offering different things. Are we at a point in your mind where kind of the iPad landscape, what Apple is offering here, is it confusing to people? I feel like if I was going there, it might be hard for me to determine between a couple of different models which one is actually the better one for me, because there's so much there. Or is choice, I mean, as we say in the Android world all the time, choice is better than no choice. So, hey, Apple, you're doing it right. What do you think?
Well, on 9to5 Mac, I called this the iPadapalooza. So we have iPads everywhere. And I think it is confusing for consumers because it's confusing for press. It's like, you need half an hour and a spreadsheet to figure out what all the different price points and features are and how they vary and how they overlap. So that is confusing. I think there's the most overlap between the iPad 10 and the iPad Air. The main difference there being, do you want to run Stage Manager where you can do multiple windows at the same time, sort of, kind of, or do you not care about that? And that's a pretty big difference in price for that one feature. I think in 2 years' time, though, we'll see the iPad 9 go away. The iPad 10 will move closer to the iPad 9's $330 price. And I could even see the 11-inch iPad Pro going away, and the iPad Pro consisting of the 12.9 and 14-point-something iPad Pro that we believe will come in 2024. So in that case, you'd have the Air be kind of the replacement for the smaller iPad Pro. And so you'd go from around $400 to around $750 to around $1,100. And that would be much easier to say, well, that one's for me, without being super confused.
Yeah, yeah, indeed, indeed. So let's wrap this interview up with one last question here. And I alluded to it in the very beginning, is that this was not an event. It was kind of like a press release sort of thing. It was pretty quiet. What is there anything to read into that? I mean, is the iPad announcement usually broadcast and this is different for Apple, or is this just the way Apple usually does the follow-up hardware event?
They did a spec bump in 2020 where they took the 2018 iPad Pro from an A12X to an A12Z chip and added LiDAR to the camera. So like really a minor change. So that was just press release, but that was also in the middle of COVID, like, or the beginning of COVID.
Yeah.
In this case, right. You know, they just did a big iPhone event, which, you know, they had an in-person aspect to that. They had a lot of people come out and attend that. So I think maybe like with the current conditions still in the world, from COVID to prices, that this was just the sensible thing to do since they just had an event last month. And in years past, they've even done things like take the iPad or the iPhone event and have the Apple Watch and have the iPad, have the Apple TV all in one event and just say it's coming in September, October, and November, which is the case here. But I think they kind of like just having the press focus be on the iPhone and watch first. And then the next month when that's kind of died down, then do the iPad and the Apple TV. And then lastly, maybe the reason is they haven't announced new MacBook Pros yet. That will also just be a spec bump to M2 Pro and Pro Max chips. So those are all kind of things that are just not, you know, major new announcements. The only thing we really lose there is the hands-on with the iPad 10 and its keyboard accessory. And once reviews come out, you know, that'll be taken care of as well. So I don't think there's too much to read into it except for, you know, yeah, things are complicated right now.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Right on. Well, Zach Hall, thanks so much for hopping on with me today. Really appreciate you coming back. Zach Hall writes for 9to5Mac. If people want to find you online, where can they find you?
I'm also on Twitter at ApolloZach. It's ApolloZach. And that's about it.
Right on. Cool. Keep up the great work, and we'll see you soon, Zach. Thank you.
Thanks, Jason.
All right. Coming up, my story of the week. It's all about how we retain generational history, things like nostalgia. I'm a very nostalgic person, so I've got some words about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Podium. If you own a small business, you know the past couple of years have been really hard, right? From supply chain issues to increased demand, on top of everything else that business owners have to manage, the businesses who are thriving right now are the ones who are forward-thinking. You always want to be forward-thinking if you own a business. At least try to. Anyways, Podium helps your small business stay ahead of the curve with modern messaging tools that make it easy for your customers to connect with your business. Now, a lot of people hate calling a business. Maybe it's a plumber. Maybe it's a landscaper, whoever it may be, and having to play phone tag. It's the worst. And they would just much rather send a quick message, right? Maybe that gets them right out of kind of the responsibility mode. Here, I've handed off to you. I can continue on with my life. So if you're running a business and the only way to get in touch with you is a phone number, you may actually be losing people. Podium gives businesses the tools to compete with the convenience offered by bigger businesses like Amazon. I actually interact with Podium thanks to my hairdresser. They check in with me when I have an appointment coming up. It's really useful, right? I get that message and I go, oh, yeah, I either remembered that meeting or I didn't. That makes sure that I remember it. And then they circle back with me afterward to get me on the books for a future appointment, maybe rate, give some feedback. It's pleasant. And more than that, it's totally effective. And that's the point. From healthcare providers to plumbers, over 100,000 businesses are texting with customers through Podium. And customers, of course, love the convenience. Businesses love the results. One car dealer sold a $50,000 truck in just 4 text messages. A jeweler sold a $5,000 ring and coordinated curbside pickup all through text. And then a dentist sent out payment requests through text and received 70% of their outstanding collections in just 2 weeks. If there's something that, you know, is really hard to talk to someone about, it's, hey, you owe me money. Shoot, if I could do that through text message, solid. Golden. With Podium's all-in-one inbox, you can do even more than just chat. You can get more online reviews, like I was talking about with my hairdresser, by sending an easy-to-use link. You can collect payments fast from anywhere, send marketing campaigns that actually get a response, all by sending a quick text. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/twit. That's podium.com/twit. Podium, let's grow. All right, more interviews coming up. But for now, my story of the week has to do with archival, and it's really top of mind for me in this moment, which I'm going to get to in a second. But the reason that I'm talking about this is because I saw this story about the Internet Archive. Now, I've talked about the Internet Archive many times. Usually when they have something new to announce, I'm like geeked about it and like, hey, everybody needs to know this. It's a site that I absolutely love. It continues to add value to its mission of archival. Now, if you don't know, the site's been around for decades at this point. They archive an insane amount of digital history. So websites are cached there from the months and the years that it's existed. So you can go back decades and see how the site used to look, when it existed, if it's gone now. Historical videos, you can borrow books, music archives, tons of live performances, old radio news broadcasts, images, and software. And this story actually has to do with the archival of software. Now, throughout the archive are terabytes of data from CDs and from floppy disks that people have added. Any number of historical computer systems. I mean, you name it, it's up there. People have an old CD or an old floppy disk. They don't want to go through the time of pulling out the useful stuff, so they just upload it in full to the Internet Archive. But what's on those disks is the real challenge, right? Those disks are full. If they're CD, tons of data in there, it can be really hard to determine exactly what's hiding in there. So the challenge ends up being these disks have so much random stuff buried inside that it's next to impossible to know what's in there. Super time consuming to go through, not to mention organizing all of that data is so that it's actually easy to access later. Well, there's a new site called Diskmaster. That's diskmaster.textfiles.com. And it's working toward the goal of combing through all of that media to make the contents easily accessible and searchable. It's even taking outdated file formats that might be difficult to do anything with at this late stage and make them viewable inside of a browser. Because as you probably know, you know, back in the 90s, there were file formats, things were not standardized. So you might have a video file and real media or some other file format that we have completely forgotten about. Docs might have been saved in a certain file format that we just don't use right now because in the beginning they thought it was going to, you know, that it was going to be great and used forever for some reason. Then we standardize around something else. It's a challenge, especially as, you know, we go decades and decades into this, this internet world that we live in. 7,000 CDs, 113 million files, 11.4 terabytes of data currently part of its archive, more added every day, right? So Diskmaster has created a program that actually scours each disk. It identifies old file formats that either are working or are not working anymore and determines how to play or to show them. And then it does the hard work of organizing that data so it's easily identifiable through the search tool on the site. So if you go to diskmaster.textfiles.com, there is a search engine on the site that allows you to poke around and find. You could even do like a vanity search. Heck, if you uploaded something, you know, years and years and years ago to the Internet Archive, you might be able to find something that that you've been looking for. If you wrote a song or I don't know what it is, but they do, by the way, have the ability to pull out information that may be sensitive or maybe personally identifiable and you don't want it in that database. So there is the ability to do that as well, because you can imagine, right? Like a CD-ROM filled with tons of data. It might have a lot of stuff that other people know of. It might also have some files that belong to you if you uploaded that disk. So, and you just didn't know about it because there's so much stuff on that CD. So there are ways to pull that out. Now, personally, I have a love for nostalgia. I'm just a very nostalgic person. I get a huge kick out of keeping old memories, old items, you know, songs I wrote when I was in high school that are horrible. Like they're anyone else would listen to them and be like, oh, this is awful. Turn it off after 10 seconds. But when I listen to them, it transports me back into an earlier version of my life. And it's really like reliving that memory later. It really takes me back to that earlier time. And I can kind of feel the excitement or enjoyment or whatever the emotion is. Now, this is all super top of mind for me right now. My father actually passed away a few weeks ago, so I'm not home right now. I'm in a friend's office doing the show because I'm back home in Boise, kind of going through all the processes, you know, post my dad passing away, kind of leading up to a memorial. And part of what I've been doing is the hard work of going through
what I did, I had no idea. I mean, my parents, you know, of course, they've taken insane amounts of pictures over the years, from when I was a kid, from when they first got married, all the way through to, you know, all the travel that they've taken throughout, you know, the many decades that they've been together, 53 years. So I'm in this position right now where I'm getting ready for this memorial that's coming up. And I took on the task of creating a slideshow, and I really wanted it to be a really solid slideshow for my father, which has, and I also realize I've never been in a situation where I could actually take the time that it requires to pull all of these things from all these different places and capture, you know, do digital capture of some of the best stuff. And it's just interesting to me how massive of a task it's been. I've loved it. I've totally enjoyed it because it's really brought me closer to my family and, you know, kind of understanding the history. But the example that I'll give you is how do we keep these collections accessible so they don't fade away, which is, I think, is core to what Discmaster and the Internet Archive is doing. My dad has an old photo album from his time in the Vietnam War. So it's ancient, it's huge, and I went to open it in this whole process, and I noticed on each of the 70 pages, certain photos were falling out. The glue that held them in is so old that at this point, the archive itself is falling apart. So I decided to capture each page and in intricate detail, you know, basically take a snapshot of what each page is supposed to look like, create a digital photo album that retains that original layout. And then I'd piece it all back together, you know, take that high res image of it, then spend some time doing some close ups, like you can see here, my dad in Thailand back when he was on R&R, of some of the most interesting images found inside. What I realized in doing this is I'm creating an archive that, at least in this way, won't deteriorate over time the way the physical album has. The physical album is so big and so kind of brittle at this point that we don't dare open it. But this is a way for me to capture it in PDF format. I suppose it's possible that PDF goes away someday, but I'm pretty certain, considering how much it's been used, that there will be someone, Discmaster or someone else, you know, making sure that it's retained for generations, hopefully. But it allows me to retain this archive in a way that I and the rest of the family can actually flip through and experience on our own time, wherever we happen to be, without the risk of destroying a family heirloom. So I guess projects like Discmaster, they give me hope because it shows what other people are doing and how they value the retention of history in the digital form the way I actually do, the way I have for decades, you know, always keeping everything, which is a curse and a blessing, let me just say. But it also shows me just how much each generation is actually tasked with managing all this stuff, right? My grandparents took so many photos, you know, at the you know, early 1990, or sorry, 1900s. There we go. That makes more sense. Early 1900s, you know, through to my parents coming into this world. And then my parents are taking all their photos. When my grandparents passed away, all of their photos went to my parents. And now I'm kind of in this process where my parents' photos are coming to me. And I think I take a lot of pictures. Like I do, I open up Google Photos. It's just, it's walls of photos. That's on top of everything, all the other generations of photos that I'm now kind of in the process of collecting, managing, digitizing, adding to my collection. It just makes me think, man, each generation has a Herculean task to then manage that cache of history and do something with it so that the next generation can kind of take the baton and carry on. And the real big question is, how do you keep this all accessible? How do you keep it organized? And I don't know that I know the answer. I know that I'm doing my part in my family, but I do know that projects like Discmaster show me that other people value it just as much as I do. And I love to see that. So that's kind of what I have for my story of the week. Very top of mind for me. And I applaud all the work that the Internet Archive and people associated with it continue to do. So go check it out for yourself. See what you can find. It's kind of like it's like geocaching on the web. What are you going to find in that little corner? Pretty cool. All right. Up next, we're going to tear apart the Pixel Watch. I'm not actually going to tear apart my Pixel Watch. I got it a couple of days ago. But Samantha Goldhart from iFixit tore it apart, and she's going to hop on and tell us all about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by SecureWorks. SecureWorks is a leader in cybersecurity. They're building solutions for security experts by security experts. Now, SecureWorks offers superior threat detection and rapid incident response, all while making sure that customers are never locked into a single vendor. Oh, we're in the midst of October. You know, we still got 11 days in the month of October. It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month, which means now is the time to raise awareness about digital security and empower everyone to protect their data from cybercrime. SecureWorks has the perfect solution for this. Now is the time to get Taegis XDR. And you might ask, why is that? Well, in 2022, cybercrime will cost the world $7 trillion. But by 2025, that figure is going to grow to $10.5 trillion. In 2021, ransomware totaled $20 billion in damages and attacks occurred every 11 seconds. But by 2031, ransomware is projected to cost $265 billion per year and strike every 2 seconds. How do you even keep up with that stuff? Make sure your organization is not the next victim, and you can do that with SecureWorks Taegis XDR. SecureWorks Taegis provides superior detection. It identifies more than 470 billion security events per day. It prioritizes the true positive alerts, eliminates alert noise, and allows organizations to focus on the real threat. And in addition, Taegis offers unmatched response with automated response actions to eliminate threats before damage is ever done. Now, with SecureWorks Taegis Managed XDR, you can easily leverage SecureWorks experts to investigate and respond to threats on your behalf so you can cut dwell times, you can decrease operational burden, and reduce cost. And with 24/7 by 365 days a year coverage, whether you experience a Christmas Day security event or half your team happens to be out sick, you can trust that SecureWorks is behind you. Now, many companies are facing a shortage of security talent, no doubt. SecureWorks acts as an extension of your security team on day one. That alleviates cybersecurity talent gaps. It allows you to customize the approach and the coverage level that you need. What happens if you've already found an intruder in your system? Well, there's no need to worry. You don't have to worry anymore. I want you to write this number down. 1-800-BREACHED. 1-800-BREACHED. That number is going to connect you with the SecureWorks Emergency Incident Response Team, and then they can provide you with immediate assistance 24/7 in responding to and remediating a possible cyber incident or data breach. At SecureWorks, you can learn more about the ways today's threat environment is evolving and the risks it can present to your organization, including case studies, reports from their counter threat unit, and more. So much to check out. Visit SecureWorks.com/twit. You'll get a free trial of Taegis XDR for going there. That's SecureWorks.com/twit. SecureWorks, defending every corner of cyberspace. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right. So like I said earlier, 2 days ago, I got my Pixel Watch. It's been on my wrist ever since. Gotta say, I'm really enjoying it. I like its kind of thin, kind of shallow form factor. It's really beautiful, I have to say, in person. However, one of the things that occurred to me almost immediately when I unboxed it, and I still kind of, you know, to this day, I mean, I've been inside a lot, so it hasn't been that much of a risk, but it still scares me. I'm frightened to crack the glass on the face. It's like a rounded glass. It feels very exposed to me. When it comes to device durability and repairability, the folks at iFixit are always on the case, and Sam Goldhart joins me right now to talk about her teardown of the Pixel Watch. Welcome, Sam.
Hi there. Hello.
How's it going? You had a fun job tearing this sucker apart.
Oh, yeah. It's been a while since I've done a smartwatch, actually. I'm happy that I didn't bust it.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm sure. I think that's probably always the goal. How can we get in there without busting it? Although, if you get in there and it is busted, I guess that tells you a certain something about it, too. It's not like you did something wrong. They just might have put it together less ideally.
Which is my favorite excuse, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, cool. It takes the pressure off of you. Cool. Well, the Pixel Watch is a Gen 1 product, of course. This is Google's first watch, first wearable. Do Gen 1 products in general, do they ever bust out of the gate, like scoring really highly in your teardowns? Or is that pretty uncommon? I mean, Apple, of course, you know, there was a time when the Apple Watch was a Gen 1 product as well. Like, what do you see when it comes to Gen 1 products in general?
Absolutely. So the difference between the repairability of a product has a lot less to do with whether it's a first generation object or a later generation object. And it's more the intent. So Apple is going for like very specific. It's going to look very nice. It's going to work very well. And their Gen 1 products will look fancier and be more polished looking, but they won't score well on repairability. So something like a Framework or a Fairphone, they'll be a little bit awkward first generation, but right out of the gate, they'll definitely be more repairable than something like an Apple Watch.
Mm-hmm. Well, and something, yeah, like the Framework built with repairability in mind, that makes a lot of sense. When I look at this watch, I do not think it, you know, just if I hadn't read the iFixit review in general, I wouldn't look at this watch and think, oh, yeah, this thing is really easy to pop open. I wouldn't even know where to begin. So let's get to the bad. No, actually, you know what? Let's hold off on the bad first. Let's start with the positive. You have one. You have a positive note in your teardown. Of course, you recorded. You released a video teardown on YouTube. There is an article kind of attached to this as well, if people prefer to read. But talk a little bit about the removable back, because I guess if there is any real positive here that you discovered, the back being removable and replaceable was it. And I think this was kind of surprising to me. I when I think of these devices, I think of glue as being bad. Like if we can avoid glue, great. But you know, you kind of pointed out that all glue is not bad. There's just better ways to do it than others. Talk a little bit about that.
That's absolutely true. And it's kind of going to show like how awesome we're getting at making all these crazy electronics. Like it feels like we've plateaued in some ways where like every smartwatch looks like every smartwatch and every smartphone looks like every smartphone. But they're really doing some incredible innovations in there, especially with adhesive. So generally we hate adhesive because it makes things really hard to get into. And then once you're in there, then you have to do all kinds of tedious removal and cleanup and all of that. But there's been some great adhesives, which are actually better than a lot of other, like, you know, proprietary screws, for example, or plastic clips that are going to break when you're opening. And this glue is an example of that. There's awesome glue in here. My guess is that it's some kind of liquid applied adhesive that goes in liquid. They seal it up. It hardens. It kind of has like a silicone caulk texture almost as you're pulling it out. Comes out beautifully clean. I don't know how to reseal it. I don't think that the tackiness stays once it's out, but it comes out really clean. And once you're going in there and prying, it actually is like pretty forgiving, but seems to have a good seal as far as IP ratings. So I'm like really stoked on this. And if like, hey, Google, you want to tell me what kind of adhesive you're using? Ship it to my house. Tell me about it.
Right. Because I mean, on one hand, it's nice that it comes apart so easily with that adhesive. But if you can't get it back together and retain kind of the integrity of the device, then that's like halfway there.
Right, exactly. Yeah, but better than nothing.
Yeah, better than nothing. Yeah, right. A good step. A great first step. Maybe next year they get the other part of that equation right.
Exactly.
All right, when you busted the watch open, you noted that the accessibility to the design is actually a big letdown. Talk about what makes it so difficult to access things like the battery, the screen. I think the crown kind of falls into that category as well. What did you find?
So this is where the Gen 1 aspect kind of comes into it, where it, instead of being like, okay, here's a logical stack of all these things, I think we see kind of a lot of compromises of they're trying to fit all these things into a tiny footprint, like granted. So when you open it up, you're immediately like, great, I have the screen, I have the battery. Oh, I can't actually remove these at all yet. So you've got to remove tiny brackets, you've got to remove the vibration motor, which like you're never really going to need to replace the vibration motor. But you need to do that so that you can access the battery, so that you can fold it up, so that you can disconnect the display. So like seems a little bit of an awkward, especially if we're going to be breaking it by bonking it around. So that can definitely be improved in later generations when they figure out, okay, well, you know, we can fix the EM interference or whatever is causing us to like wrap this around this way. Maybe do like contacts instead of a connector cable for the vibration motor or, you know, something like that. But that'll be
fun. I suppose if you're breaking open or tearing open a device to replace a component and you can't help but break something else in order to get the thing that was originally broken. That's not a good thing at all. That's what you want to hopefully avoid. You do talk a little bit about
is it Captain or Captain?
Captain, I think. Yeah. Captain,
okay. All right. Well, there we go. I thought it was the first. But anyways, you talk about the fact that that tape was found inside of the battery mechanism. The screenshots in the video actually make it look kind of funny because it really does look like a little plastic package is just hanging out inside this thing.
Yeah.
Things that kind of feel a little cheap, even if that's, you know, maybe that's a standard. I don't know. But what makes Kapton tape so undesirable aside from its looks? Or maybe
it's probably mostly the looks. And I think I'm probably just being a little judgmental because you do find this in electronics. Generally, though, it's on kind of the lower end electronics. For example, you'll never find it in Apple things. I think that's probably like an instantly fireable offense if you put Kapton tape.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
But it's very useful. It's good for isolation for electronics, protecting small electronics, and it's good for heat management. You use this oftentimes in soldering. You'll put kind of Kapton tape over the top while you're soldering to protect other components from getting fried. To me, it's usually an instance of this is a last minute fix where like, oh, we're getting some interference or, oh, we're worried about this contact touching this thing. Let's just slap some Kapton tape in there and it'll be great. And that's a good solution. But it also sort of indicates to me that we aren't being as thoughtful as we could. And so maybe there are some other items along the way that would have been fixed if we had the time for it.
Yeah, yeah, and no doubt, you know, that again, it goes back to what will the second generation look like? I'm sure, I'm sure Google is seeing that too, right? Like anyone who respects the hardware that they're making would look inside and see that and also compare it to the industry leaders and be like, you know, we do want this to actually look like a premium product as well. And sometimes things like that just make it seem a little cheap for whatever
reason. I think a lot of this probably comes down to, and this is like rumor and hearsay, but this has kind of been languishing in the like production cycle for a while. So I think we're probably working with a little bit of older hardware and we probably had a little bit of a rush as far as like someone finally came down and was like, all right, that's it. We're releasing it this holiday season. And everyone had to kind of be like, oh, okay, let's, you know, tie a bow around it and slap some Kapton tape in there. <I guess.
laughs> Right, right. That's probably exactly how it went too. So address, if you will, my concerns for the display glass. When I saw, I don't know if it was the same for y'all at iFixit, but I saw those rounded edges. It just seems very vulnerable to me. And The Verge, they had their moment with a cracked display during their review process, so it's not unfounded. How easy would it be to swap out that component if need be? Because I see that as being a major component that will probably need to be swapped out more than other things in this watch.
Absolutely. Yeah, for wearables and portables, like the screen is probably the most vulnerable. We always say that the screen and the battery are the most important. The battery will wear out regardless of if you're wearing the thing or not. Like if you lock that up in a box and you protect it forever, you're still going to have to replace the battery. But you're going to be wearing the thing, so the screen is going to be the next there. The process, like, it's not too hard to get to the screen. It's just, it needs a lot of help. Like a guide is really what you need to kind of get in there and make sure you don't lose the tiny contact pieces and all of these different things. And I mentioned in the video that like, when you pry up a battery, it's a little bit scary because you never know if that battery is going to be perfectly intact and safe, or if you've, you know, poked some layers, or if the bits are going to be a little like, well, I don't know, if they're a little less secure after you've been poking around and heating it. And you do have to fold that battery up to get to the screen. So like, that is my major hesitation. But otherwise, it's awkward and sideways, but it is replaceable. And the screen is just the screen. So there's not a lot of tertiary components mounted to it, where you would need to like peel that off or pay a premium because there's more on there. As far as the breakability, it's definitely not like the strongest glass out there. They've got the sapphire, I believe, on the underside, but not on the top. It's just Gorilla Glass. The Verge like really puzzled me. I would love to see that that crack a little bit more up close, because it looked like the crack was only at the top, unless I missed something and it didn't propagate down the side. But that was obviously my assumption, is that like when you smack it on the side, that's where the crack is going to come from. But it didn't seem to be the case with the Verge. So I'm very curious to see how that happened there. It's we're going to kind of see, I think, if this is going to be a common issue. Hopefully Google can give us some parts to keep things going. It is funny to follow right up on the heels of the Ultra, which made a huge deal of like, oh my gosh, we've got these solid sides, and it's even, you know, a bit proud of the display itself. So like, you're not going to bang it or whatever. So unfortunate timing for them, I guess.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well, we love bringing folks from iFixit onto this show. I love the process that you all take and the care that you take in showing us how repairable our devices are. Because in this day and age, like, I don't know, I think it's pretty safe to say that probably the majority of us technology users have dropped a phone at some point or, run into a wall with their wearable display and everything. So we all see the benefit of knowing and understanding how repairable and how durable our devices are. So thank you for doing the work that you do. Samantha Goldhart, of course, you can check out her her video teardown of the Pixel Watch and go to iFixit. You can also see a write-up on that. If people want to follow you online, where can they find you?
I'm on Twitter. I'm Beluga of Justice, which is a high school screen name that I should probably change at some point. But mostly I'm just on iFixit. Follow our homepage.
Right on. No, I say keep it. Wear it proudly. Thank you so much, Sam. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, we'll see you soon. All right, and we do have one more interview coming up. We're going to talk a little bit about Netflix. They're making some changes. They just had their earnings report. It was pretty good. What does it mean for the future of Netflix after a couple of really bad earnings reports? Well, that's coming up with Yonka Rutgers from Protocol. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat devoted to simplifying tech topics and providing insight for a new generation of IT professionals. It's actually hosted by Angela Andrews and Brent Simoneau. And Compiler closes the gap between those who are new to technology and those behind the inventions and behind the services that are really shaping our world. Compiler brings together stories and perspectives from the industry. It simplifies its language, its culture, and movements in a way that's just really fun. It's informative and guilt-free. So if you want to stay on top of tech without the time spent, well, an original podcast from Red Hat, that is Compiler, presents perspectives, topics, and insights from the tech industry free from jargon, free from judgment. They want to discover where technology is headed beyond just the headlines and then create a place for new IT professionals to learn, grow, and thrive. Compiler actually helps people break through barriers and challenges, turning code into community at all levels of the enterprise. And they've got some really great episodes. One episode called The Great Stack Debate. The software stack, you know, you may or may not know, it's kind of like peeling an onion or maybe a sheet cake or a lasagna. Now, by the way, I'm very, very hungry. Or is it? It's often described as having layers that sit on top of each other, but the reality is much more complicated. And learning about it can actually help any tech career. The Great Stack Debate is the first episode in Compiler's series on the software stack. They call it Stack Unstuck, and they explore each layer of the stack, what it's like to work on them, and how they come together into a whole application. And I promise you, unlike peeling an onion, it won't make you cry. Another episode covers, are we as productive as we think? You know, the pressure to balance productivity with passion projects, personal responsibilities, or just with the need to rest, it can be really challenging. And their team spoke with tech-minded creators in the productivity space on how to achieve full focus, how to make time for work, but I feel like more importantly, how to make time for relaxation and creativity. It's fascinating. The episode is great. It's so apropos to now because we're all working where we live. Well, not all of us, but you know, many of us are still, and many of us did before. So it's really hard. It's a challenge to separate the two sometimes, but it's truly essential. That's how we avoid burnout. It's how we find enjoyment in our lives. Definitely check that episode out on productivity. Learn more about Compiler at red.ht/twit. You can listen to Compiler in your favorite podcast player. We'll also include a link in the show notes. And our huge thanks to Compiler for their support. Keep up the great work. All right, Netflix, like I said, had its earnings this week. Things seem to be improving for the company with an added 2.4 billion subscribers globally. This after two consecutive quarters prior that saw first-time losses for the company. So it was kind of like, what's going on? The sky is falling. You know, everything's changing for Netflix. They had a good quarter, and that's a good thing for them. Joining me to talk about the shifting headwinds and the future plans for the company is Yonka Rutgers from Protocol. Welcome back.
Sure. Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. I always love getting you on. So let's talk a little bit about Netflix. First of all, the executives on the call, they were quick, I would say, to proclaim And this is a quote: "Thank God we're done with shrinking quarters." Oof! I feel like when you say that, you're really taking a gamble. When you say we're done with blank, I mean, is it too early to take a victory lap here? What are your thoughts on that?
I know it's famous last words, right? Nothing could possibly go wrong with that.
Oh,
I think they do have a little bit of advantage there, that they have some things going for them in the next couple of months. First of all, they do the new quarter has just started. We're like 20 days in now, but I think they have a fairly good idea of where things are going. And Netflix is forecasting now to add 4.5 million people, subscribers rather, this quarter. So that sounds pretty good already. And then next year, they have a couple of things, a couple of initiatives. First of all, they're starting the ad-supported tier, which is going to be cheaper. So that's a way for people to maybe sign on to the service who want to save some money, especially now that everything is getting more expensive. That's a good thing. And then they're also starting to crack down, or as the company would like to put it, monetize account sharing, which then will force some people to think, am I going to give up on Netflix, or am I willing to pay a little bit to maybe add another account or subscribe for the first time? And I think that would also add a bunch more people to their subscriber base.
Yeah, right. No doubt. Well, you're talking about the crackdown on passwords. They've been testing this kind of new way, this new feature or, you know, way to get people to pay. I think that obviously the big challenge here is that for years, Netflix really seemed to be kind of happy to allow that to happen. And now they're kind of undoing that work. But how does this system, this data transfer between accounts, which is kind of the new feature that I'm talking about, how does that work? What exactly is Netflix enabling with this new feature? What are they hoping happens through the implementation of this?
Yeah, so that was sort of a first step that they announced this week. Basically, anybody can now spin off a profile. So Netflix has had profiles for years where you can set up different profiles for different people in your household. But people have obviously also been using this to keep grandma on the same account without having her mess up your recommendations, right? So it's also good for account sharing. And now you can start to take one of those profiles and from within the profile say, take all this data and add it to a new account. Start a new account basically with all my recommendations, with all my past viewing, with everything that has been personalized for me in the past. That's being built as something that helps people, you know, who, I don't know, break up, move out of the house, for whatever other reason, want to start their own account. But obviously, it's going to come into play next year as well when they start to really crack down on this and say and tell everybody who's been watching Netflix under the same account, maybe from multiple IP addresses, from multiple households, that they have to stop doing this and find other ways.
Yeah, and they were testing this. They had a few different trials. Like, did those trials, I mean, they must have gone well if they're moving forward with this. What kind of feedback do we know as far as how that fared and what it led to?
Yeah, so the company said that has been well received, very well received. They tested it in a couple of countries in Latin America. There have been anecdotal reports of people getting mad at it. And I would imagine once they start rolling it out, you will see both. You will see people being really pissed off about it because in the past, Netflix said, oh, it's fine. You can share your account. Don't worry. We have simultaneous streams. You can't share with 1,000 people. We're all good with that. And now they're suddenly going to start charging for it. But they did find an interesting way, and they've been testing this out in a couple of different ways, where it doesn't feel quite as punitive, because instead of saying, oh, you have to stop doing this, otherwise you're going to like block your account or anything like that, they're going to say, we noticed that you are sharing your account with other people, that other people are watching maybe from a different household under your account. Do you want to keep them on? Do you want to pay a couple dollars extra to keep grandma on your account or to keep your college buddy on your account? Or do you want to encourage them to maybe start over and start their own account? And in that way, it appeals to people's generosity, I guess, as opposed to like just punishing them for something that was okay in the past, which is a pretty clever way. Whether it's going to work with everybody, we have to see. But I would imagine it will be a net positive for the company in the end.
Yeah, and I'll be really curious to know what is the price difference. If I'm sharing my account with somebody else and then Netflix says, you know, you can keep them on or they can pay for themselves. If they're paying for themselves, we know what that cost is going to be. That's going to be, you know, 13 or, you know, maybe it's the ad-supported tier, which we'll talk about in a second. But it's going to be, I'm guessing it's going to be more and probably a reasonable amount more than the added cost for an extra user on your account. I don't know, obviously we don't know what those price differences are going to be, but, you know, kind of playing to the generosity of someone that I'm in the position of being like, well, you know what? It's cool. I can just pay $3 extra for that person. When I meet up with them, they can, you know, buy me lunch or something.
Exactly. Something along those lines. They haven't said yet how much it's going to be, but I would imagine it's going to be somewhere in between that. Maybe it's not going to be $3. Yep. Maybe it's going to be a little bit more. But one way to think about it is right now when Netflix resells their service, or when basically when you buy Netflix through Apple or through Google, through a third party, they get a 30% cut, right? So Netflix could say, we're going to keep that cut, so but why don't we make it 30% cheaper? Why don't we make it 40% cheaper? So it's not going to be just like $1 or $2, I think, but it will be cheap enough to maybe like, yeah. If you're feeling good about it, if you have a couple extra dollars, you're going to maybe decide to keep somebody on there.
Right. So then let's focus a little bit on the ad-supported tier. This has been, you know, in the works for a little while now. Now we've kind of, you know, we have it confirmed. It's looking like this is going to happen. What does this plan actually look like? And do you feel like it's competitive enough or compelling enough for people who don't want to pay, you know, $15 for a Netflix service? Are they going to be okay in your mind with the trade-offs of having an ad-supported tier, considering how many ads they're going to be seeing for the content?
Right. So it's launching next month, just actually in 2 weeks, I guess, in 12 countries. It will be $6.99, which is significantly cheaper than what most people pay for Netflix nowadays. In exchange, you will have to watch about 5 minutes of advertising per hour, or at least that's what the company says now. There are going to be like a few exceptions. The catalog won't be totally complete. So there might be some shows and some movies that you won't be able to watch on the ad-supported service, because it turned out when they contract with other companies, when they license content from other movie studios or from TV networks, they didn't include that in the original contracts, and sometimes they didn't want to go back and renegotiate that and pay a lot more. So some of the content won't be available, but obviously we'll be able to watch all the Netflix originals on that and a bunch of other stuff as well. And I think the big thing that Netflix got going for it here is really the price tag, because ad-supported services that you also have to pay for, it's not entirely new. HBO has been doing that for a while. So you can subscribe to HBO Max with ads, but that's $10 a month. And Disney is going to launch their own Disney Plus ad-supported plan in December, I think. But that's going to be $8 or $7.99. So Netflix is really undercutting the competition here, which is quite remarkable, because so far it's been one of the more expensive services out there, especially when you compared it to what Disney Plus started with and all those things, or when you compare it with an Apple TV subscription.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, they just have so many originals that even if it's a limited library, but it's all the Netflix originals, for a lot of people, that's exactly what they're signing up for anyways. They want to see the next season of Stranger Things or whatever the case may be. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, we also have some big news that we haven't even touched on yet, that Netflix is confirmed to be looking into cloud gaming. And this has been something, you know, a topic that's been thrown around, I'd say, the last couple of years. Like, what if Netflix, you know, got into gaming? What would that look like? This would be another avenue for its service. What kinds of games, what would this even look like? What do we know about its cloud gaming ambitions?
Unfortunately, we know fairly little about it, other than that they're going to do it. There were some hints earlier this year, and then finally this week, they confirmed that they're looking into it. It was pretty much a confirmation that they're going to launch it or go with it. We know from what they're doing in mobile so far that they're basically trying pretty much everything, throwing stuff on the wall at the wall and then see what sticks. So there's very casual games, there's games connected to Netflix titles, there's like odd stuff like SpongeBob SquarePants Cooking Club or something like that. I don't know, I may have butchered that title, but things that you wouldn't really expect and that don't really appeal to hardcore gamers necessarily. I would imagine that they will go for some titles that look like hardcore gaming titles or AAA gaming titles there, because they really want to go onto TVs. They weren't going to go onto, you know, other environments that people usually play games on that have game consoles. So it's not just about a casual mobile game that you play 5 minutes, but it's going to be there where you play your other games on TVs, on PCs, appealing to a gamer audience, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that's the more compelling offer of the two, right? Like mobile games on our phones and everything like that. That's, you know, we've been there, done that. But if Netflix was to offer some sort of Stadia, rest in peace, but Stadia like experience through the Netflix app that we already have running on our TV, that would be super compelling, right? That might actually be the missing piece that Stadia wasn't able to get. Some sort of, you know, very major, already widely adopted vector for people to be exposed to this kind of technology. One thing that strikes me, though, is VP of Game Development Mike Verdu admitted that games wouldn't rely on the standard TV controllers. And that's super important. In my mind, if they're doing any sort of, you know, cloud gaming play, offering that through their apps, you know, they need some sort of a game focused controller. Do we have an indication that's what he's referring to? Is he saying it wouldn't be the standard TV controller, it would be a game controller, or he hasn't been clear on that at this point?
I think so. And Mike Verdu was at TechCrunch Disrupt this week, and he got asked about that pretty specifically. So are you going to make your own game controller? Do you want to make your own hardware? Stuff like that. And he didn't want to commit to that. I could see them maybe also just say, oh, we're going to support third-party Bluetooth controllers. There's plenty of stuff out there already. Maybe you can recycle your Stadia controller. Who knows?
There we go.
But it makes a lot of sense because we've seen this stuff in the past. I think many, many years ago, Roku did this weird deal with Angry Birds where you could play Angry Birds on your Roku streaming stick. And nobody does that. It's not a good experience. It's weird with a D-pad to play really games for a long time. You want a game controller, right? If you really want to play games, you want to have a game controller. You want to use the same stuff. And also on PCs, obviously, people who are used to PC gaming don't just want to, I don't know, use their keyboard. They want to be able to use game controllers and all that stuff. And to appeal to that audience, they have to support that kind of hardware.
Yeah, I would say so too. It would kind of be a big misstep if they came out with something that was anything else. And I, as I'm thinking about it right now, I don't know what else it could possibly be. What a, you know, some in between a TV controller and a game controller. I don't see them doing that. So I think you're right. There's got to be some sort of major kind of gaming controller play. Well, that remains to be seen. Yanko, really appreciate you taking time to talk all about, you know, the many movements happening with Netflix right now. Yanko Rutgers, of course, writes for Protocol.com. If people want to find you online, where can they find you?
Again, on Protocol. That's our number one, the best way to find me. Otherwise, just Google me, Google my name, and you can find me on Twitter at JANK0. But Google my name and you can find me on all the platforms.
Right on. Thank you again, Yanko. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I appreciate your time.
Sure.
All right. We've reached the end of this episode. Jam-packed. Man, what a great episode. I had a lot of fun today. We've got Micah returning to the show next week. I'll be returning to, I don't know if I'm returning to the actual Petaluma studio or my studio in the corner of my bedroom back home. That remains to be seen, but I'll be happy to have Micah back. So I'm looking forward to that. Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. That's where you can go to find all the ways to subscribe, audio, video formats. It's all listed there and easy to find. If you want all of our shows without any of the ads, we love our ads. We love our sponsors. But if you prefer to have your shows without those ads inserted in, well, check out Club Twit. And we know you're going to love what you get there. $7 a month gives you every Twit episode, every Twit show with no ads, an exclusive Twit Plus feed with tons of extra content, shows that are exclusive to the club, and a members-only Discord channel or Discord access. Twit.tv slash Club Twit. You can also, by the way, subscribe to individual shows. If you're on Apple Podcasts and you've just got one show and you're like, you know what, I want to support this one show, I don't want ads in Tech News Weekly. So you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts for $2.99 a month. You'll get the audio feed without, you know, any ads in it as well that way. So check it out. Support us with the club, and we appreciate when you do that. And that's really it, folks. I'm Jason Howell, at Jason Howell on Twitter if you want to find me there. I also do All About Android every Tuesday, twit.tv/AAA, and then producing, you know, This Week in Google, Security Now, This Week in Tech behind the scenes. So even if you don't see me on the show, you better believe I'm working behind the scenes to make those shows happen. And who else is working behind the scenes? John Ashley, Burke McQuinn at the studio. Thank you so much for your help each and every time we do this show. And thanks to you out there for watching and listening. And yeah, we'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Hey, folks, I'm Matt Pruitt. I have a question for you. How do you think your hardworking team, with a Club Twit corporate subscription plan, of course, show your appreciation and reward your tech team with a subscription to Club Twit. Keep everyone informed and entertained with podcasts covering the latest in tech. With a Club Twit subscription, they get access to all of our podcasts ad-free. And they also get access to our members-only Discord, access to exclusive outtakes and behind-the-scenes footage and special content like the Fireside Chats that I enjoy hosting. Plus, they also get shows like Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. So go to twit.tv/clubtwit and look for corporate plans for complete details.